welcome to Season 7 of The Process Podcast, an interview series exploring the process of survival as a creative. For this season, we're going back to our roots and talking to all sorts of creatives from a wide variety of industries, backgrounds, and creative endeavors about how they make it all work, from mental health to relationships to money to the creative process itself, and a whole lot more. I'm your host, Shannon Byrne, and I'm just trying to figure it out like the rest of us. Big thanks to the band Blessed for letting us use our song Endure as our intro music for this season. You can find their music at Blessed, that's B-L-E-S-S-E-D, band.bandcamp.com, or wherever you buy your music. And to Hannah Spencer for all of the design and branding and the strategy work she does for us. And Lonnie Webb for running our social media. Thank you for listening. Hope y'all dig it. Hey, hello. This is my second recording of the intro because the last one was a little bit too doom and gloom. I'm going to start this one out by saying I hope this finds you safe and healthy and finding things to do. I hope you're staying home and doing what you can to slow down the spread of the coronavirus. Don't worry, I won't say too much about current events, but I will say that. And I will say I hope everyone is doing okay, as best as you can be doing. And that you all are being there for each other and being there for your friends and family and animals. If you are finding yourself picking up new hobbies and you would like podcasting to be one, or trying to sell stuff on the internet, trying to get into the e-commerce game, both Hannah and I are here to lend you any advice or suggestions, or just hop on the phone and brainstorm some ideas. We're happy to do that, just as friends with you. Hannah has a link to schedule time with her in her Instagram bio. She's I am Hannah Ellen on Instagram. You can find the link there. Just reach out through the process, hi@theprocess.co, or on our social media to reach me. And I'm happy to chat with whoever could use, again, just a ear. Or my background is in marketing and writing. I've done all sorts of digital stuff. So, I don't know. Maybe it can help. Anywho, so there's that. Also, we missed a week. For those who notice those type of things, I just couldn't do it, pretty much. I had too many balls in the air, and the time that I would usually spend on the podcast went to helping some friends get their music on Bandcamp before the Bandcamp fundraiser last Friday. So yeah, that felt more pressing and urgent than getting a podcast episode up. So that's what I did. But here we are. Anyway, this week we have Greg Vegas, who is the founder and president of International Rescue Artist Development, as well as a record label, Declared Goods. He has worked with bands such as Holy Ship, Little Children, Ed Valance, Blackstrap, The Heart of the Sun, The Arthur Brothers, Gringo Starr, The Radio Department, and more. He does a lot of digital releases, which is relevant to our current environment and the music industry, so keep that in mind as you're listening to this. Greg is also a musician and a well-known saxophone player, and has worked in a variety of roles in the music industry for most of his life. He's also the director of label management at The Orchard, which is one of the big and beloved music distributors. So he's been in the industry for a long time and knows it very, very well. We did record this episode way before COVID, in a very pre-COVID world. That said, so I listened to it over the past couple of days through the lens of a current COVID and post-COVID world, and I found that with some, not even much critical thinking, just a little bit, the ideas that we talk about can and should still be applied. Things like getting your music in front of new ears is still very important. Being creative in doing so is more crucial than it's ever been. Getting your team, whether that's just you, or you and a couple of people, or you and a friend, or you're just your band, aligned in the early days is a necessity. That's always been good advice and always will be. You still have to practice to improve at your art. We talk about a whole lot more. When I was listening to the episode, I was like, holy shit, artists should be putting these virtual shows that they're organizing that are really hard to find and hard to organize up on Songkick and Bands in Town or whatever, wherever Spotify pulls shows from. Like, Spotify should be displaying them. I don't know how easy that is. I work in tech, but I don't do tech. But that seems doable, right? And that all came from listening to what Greg was saying about how one of the biggest points of playing shows, of touring and playing gigs, is being listed on these sites and just like getting your name out there. So you can still do that by sharing your shows on these platforms. It's just they're on the internet instead of at different venues around the world. I am sure that there is something out there already doing that, but anyway, that's just an example of what I got from this episode while listening to it through that lens. Like, okay, here are the basic foundations of a music business or a career as a musician that, like, when I say basic, I don't necessarily mean simple, because we talk a lot about a lot of stuff that I just don't think we all think about on a regular basis when it in terms of like what all goes into building a career as a musician. So yeah, he shares a lot of that, and I don't think a lot of that changes those basic fundamentals. It's just how we apply them is changing. There's a lot of goodness though about DIY distribution and avoiding certain scammy things in the industry. That's also relevant. Different potential revenue streams for artists and bands, the value of having a team. I hope you find this episode helpful. Huge thanks to Greg Vegas of Declared Goods for sharing his knowledge with us. Hopefully, we'll be back with a regular episode next week. We'll see. And yeah, I think that's it. Keep it easy. Again, I hope everyone's safe and well. Let us know how you're doing, and we'll catch you next week. Cheers, y'all. I guess to start, do you want to just say who you are and what you do?
Yeah, my name is Greg Vegas. Live here in Brooklyn, New York, and I am a guy with many hats, basically, and been in the industry for a while. I'm an artist manager, have a label, have a consulting business working with artist development, have a day job working in distribution, but pretty much do a little everything.
Yeah. How long have you been working in music in general?
Since that's all I've ever done, really.
Is
So,
it really?
yeah,
No.
I played in bands. I started my career started in the 80s, so really starting at college radio, when the college radio was were the blogs of the day. They were the, I worked at a radio station in Connecticut that was sort of like one of the pitchforks of the, it was the tastemaker, station that had access to a lot of stuff everybody wanted. You add this, add your the new song, whatever. But I cut my teeth in college radio and then playing music and kind of, I was a musician, playing saxophone, studying saxophone actually, initially, and then quickly wanted to play Jesus and Mary Chain guitar, feedback, and just kind of made noise with friends, and next thing you know, I was in a band, and then playing a lot, and then booking shows because my band needed a gig, and then just kind of had created a community of, basically, when you actually had to write letters to bands, other bands, and make phone calls with quarters, like the days of like trying to figure out how the hell we do that back then. But anyway, it started just basically on an energy level of trying to be excited about new sounds and finding other like bands, and then got myself a record deal with Atlantic Records in the early '90s, my band Monsterland, and then we broke up, and then I immediately kind of ran into the distribution business. When distribution was actually shipping physical product, basically, which was a kind of whole different level of distribution that doesn't really, that still exists, but like that was a, there was a, distribution was very important because if you didn't have it, you didn't get your stuff out there.
Right.
And we can touch on that a bit more, how it's changed, but yeah, so my career, I've always done music, basically. Of course, I've had a job as a cook and, work as a stock guy in a warehouse type stuff, the stuff you do when you're a musician, to pay the bills,
Right, totally. Cool. What brought you to New York?
Well, I'm from Connecticut, so it wasn't really that far away. So I actually initially, I used to even skip school in high school to come down, just, you know, hang out once in a while. It was that close enough. But I was working for a company in the Danbury, Connecticut area, which is right on the New York border. And the job, I was working for distribution that moved to New York City. Mm. So at one point I was commuting from Connecticut like 2 hours each way to come down here, and eventually moved down here. Or moved close and moved to Westchester, and then moved to Brooklyn. And I probably got here a couple years too late in some ways, because I wasn't too sure about, really knew much about Brooklyn. But once I kind of got here, I was probably just about 2 years late before a certain sense of real estate prices, and probably shouldn't have made a move a little earlier, kind of thing. But anyway, I ended up here in the, I was a late 90s. But yeah, this is what the music business was, and being from Connecticut was always kind of proximity. And there's actually a lot of people from my scene in Connecticut who are down here still.
Okay.
We're all kind of still kind of connected, even music industry people.
Yeah. Are you interested at all, like, kind of giving a brief overview of what the scene was like then?
Well, you know, so 98, I mean, I'm trying to remember, I was, I mean, this is the days, I guess, when... it's all blur now. I'm trying to think. But I mean, I wasn't one of those people that were going out to gigs all the time. And, you know, I'm trying to think now. Yeah, so it would have been around, I'm thinking blurring in like the early 2000s and late 90s. But yeah, I mean, Williamsburg was still kind of like still new and early. Mm-hmm. So like, to me, it was still about going to like Manhattan shows, and then all of a sudden it was like finding these weird places you went to in Williamsburg, which I didn't really know much about, because I lived down in the South Brooklyn near Park Slope, Windsor Terrace area.
Yeah.
Which was kind of just a lot of families and stuff, not much down there. But eventually, yeah, it was just like there was people I bumped into, and then all of a sudden there was some clubs in the area, like my buddy Skippy opened the place down in there was all of a sudden like the Bell House was down in Gowanus and Union Hall, and there was things for us to do. But a cake shop was a lot of the scene in the early 2000s. The Boaters were friends from Connecticut from way back. And I can't even remember. I find I don't even think of myself being part of the scene sometimes. I just feel like I'm just, you know, I've always had the gig working. I worked in distribution at that point. So I was up and worked with like Touch and Go and Beggars and Matador and Domino, all these great labels. So I was always at gigs in the sense of being... seeing these great bands. And like, remember seeing like Fleet Foxes at Union Hall in front of like with like 50 people there. Oh, I think there was very few people, or Courtney Barnett Kate LeBon with like 10 people, you know, those kind of things. So I'd always be at those early shows because the labels would invite me. So that was kind of the insider industry type
right. thing. Yeah. It's funny that you mentioned college radio. Tomorrow my next article gets published, and it's Why Non-Commercial Radio Matters to Your Career is the title. Because I feel like it does still matter.
I think, you know, and college radio isn't it. That's my DNA. And you know, college radio growing up, you know, in the 80s, and you know, when I lived in Connecticut, and I had access to like three cool college stations, the University of New Haven, the University of Bridgeport, were two key ones. And also, so there was like always kind of cool music being played, and you'd turn the dial. And then I went to work at a station at WXCI in Danbury when I went to college, which was a pretty big deal up there. But it was also like they all kind of mimicked a lot what was going on in New York, which was WLIR, which is a big commercial station that played, it was a kind of a breakthrough new wave station. So there was actually a recent documentary about them, which is kind of interesting. But anyway, there was a lot of, it was kind of close enough to kind of feed it, but the fact that we could do whatever we want, you know, in a sense. And but I said, like, the station I worked at was, if we added the song to the rotation, it was a big deal, because it was like that was a star. It's how you broke bands, you know.
Yeah.
So we'd get access to all these great artists at the time, wherever the hot band was. But they would made sure the station in Danbury, Connecticut was adding it, so I get invited to shows. And I remember, like, you know, hanging with the Pixies when invited at a release show, like, that nobody was at, and meeting the Happy Mondays, and, you know, and they're like already wasted before their release party started, and, you know, so it was like had a lot of great access to that stuff. But there was the community, because there was like also conventions, like CMJ was a big convention then. So college radio is mixed. Obviously there's less college radio these days,
yeah,
I find it really fascinating. I still do. I did a college radio show until about 2002 at the station. I actually commuted from Brooklyn up to Connecticut for a while, just because this was my thing to do. I loved doing it. Eventually, I was just like, this is crazy. And I would fill in occasionally on like East Village Radio and various shows. I mean, but the idea of like, my thing was always like finding great music and playing it for people, right? So yeah. It's like, and you know, so like exposing it in bigger ways. And then, but I go up to do this maybe once or twice a year, I go up to the station that I came from in Danbury. And it's interesting how, like, you know, I find there's missing, you know, depending where you go to school, I guess, where the schools are, right? Because it's really mostly what it's about. There's, you know, some of them don't really care, and some of them, the fact that they still exist, but I feel like they don't utilize, I still think they haven't really utilized the idea of college radio and podcasts are the same things.
Right.
No one's actually seemed to grasp that yet. I kind of find it fascinating. It's like, a podcast, that's what I did in 1986. You know, yeah. It's like, it's just different format. I mean, it's just people talking about music or talking about things, you know. So it's the same, it's all the same. But, mm-hmm. you know, so the idea of like, also I always say when I talk about marketing records, bands I work with and labels, it's like, you know, if you do college radio servicing, you're basically hitting up passionate music people who probably have a blog.
Right.
So there's a whole connection of a community and, you know, the purpose of like getting on a, you know, number 99 on the top 100 chart, like, it doesn't really make the difference. Is anybody going to buy, you know, stream your track, you know, 100,000 times? Probably not. But the idea of like, it just announces you exist. And the idea of like, yeah, the local, whoever does listen, the station is going to hear it. But now you have people who are fans, you know?
Yeah.
So there's it's an important part of the music discovery process.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm always kind of like, start thinking about like, I really wish some of these schools would really kind of put the money into where it's like, I went to school as communication arts. It was a part, there was a radio business. It was the only way to get stuff out there.
Yeah.
So anyway, it's not about the terrestrial anymore, but the idea of like the, you know, when you have like KXP and all these great stations and, you know, even FMU that are, you know, broadcasting all over the world, and you meet people like, oh, I discovered you in FMU. Like, where are you from? I'm from like, you know, Greece. It doesn't matter. You know, they find the cool music. You know?
Yeah. I talked to Jeff Conklin for that article.
Oh, yeah.
He had like some cool insights.
No, Jeff. But yeah, and that's the idea of like, you know, having a freedom, people taking chances.
Yeah.
You know, I got a record. Oh, cool. I'm going to put this on. And I still have the tapes of all my shows from back in the day. So,
oh, cool.
Like actual audio tapes, which is kind of scary. But it's like, but it's to see what I played. You know, wow, I played that in 1992.
Yeah.
But anyway, it's the idea of like, you know, it's a creative outlet for people who, you know, again, part of the process. And again, like now we're talking, but what is replacing? What is radio? Playlists is now streaming services, and there's algorithms, and there's all this stuff that kind of replaced the sort of curation, you mm-hmm. know, meaning like, oh, I like your, you know, I'm a guy who tastes, and I want to choose some stuff, you know, put it in there. And I think that's important. We still need those people. And I think they are still involved in that kind of playlisting game, but it's like, that's the great thing about radio. Somebody can just have a buddy like, I'm a fan, I'm going to play this. There's no reason I don't. There's no reason for me not to play it. Just want to play because I like it.
You know,
we need that.
Right. Yeah, I agree. And
same with reviews of, you know, writing reviews and stuff like that. People should be able to write stuff that's like they dig, you know?
Right. And not just, writing things because so-and-so sponsors.
Because we're like, going to, yeah. Unfortunately, it's coming to that. But, you know, like John Peel is the great story. That guy broke, you know, a million bands because he just dug him for whatever reason, right? John Peel's the famous DJ, and everyone wants to be the John Peel, but not everybody has the ability to do that.
Yeah. I have a theory that a lot of, like, music supervisors and label runners and people like that are listening to
community college
radio. Like, it's an unfounded theory, but...
Absolutely. I think it all goes together. I think one point when I was in college radio in the late 80s, I mean... It was very important for us to add it, and it was we were that gatekeeper, tastemaker. And it's the same way, like MTV was you got to get played on MTV back in the day because they played the video, and that's how people. But now there's so many. It's not like not one or two things, and of course Pitchfork was that for a long time here. But that's, you know, everything's so dissipated. But if you do all those things, in theory, it could work if it all clicks, right? You get the things, the radio, college radio is playing. You get some reviews. You're doing some touring. There's a couple playlist things happening, and hopefully it all kind of clicks. But it's not one thing that's going to make the difference, but it's all part of the process.
Right. Yeah, totally. When you're managing bands, is that like, are you also educating them on that? Do most understand that at this point?
I think so. I mean, like, you know, I've worked a lot of European artists or Scandinavian artists, which is kind of a different thing, you know, but when you're dealing with, but mainly it's about showing how the US works, and radio in general is a frustrating process, especially when you get to the bigger level beyond college radio. It takes forever to get things happening, you know, and it's a sad state of affairs when dealing with like commercial radio and what's, you know, again, talk about being scrutinized, you know, nothing gets just added because somebody likes it. You know, it's like tested for like, you know, for like 2 months before anybody decides on something. But yeah, no, it's, I think it's, that's part of the, what I work with, the artists I work with is the idea of like, hey, this is some ways it sort of works, or we can do this, but I don't think there's any one way of doing it. I mean, I think sometimes there's always a, try a different approach, but yeah, it's showing that idea of like, all right, we gotta just don't focus on that. Like I remember, like it was always about Pitchfork for a while. If you don't get the review on Pitchfork, nobody, everybody was upset. You know, if it's like, well, if you don't get the Pitchfork, then what do you, you know, what are you gonna do? You can't just quit. You know, it's like if you don't get the playlist you want, like you gotta still exist, right? You're just gonna keep moving forward and do your thing, right? So that's just always the process of the what I call managing disappointments and expectations.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah,
I think that's basically the big process, and then trying to figure it out, because I think it's, you know, I generally work in a more DIY sphere, you know, and I've had stuff on major labels and stuff that I work in management wise, but generally I'm kind of doing stuff with the band ourselves, you know, or working with small labels that are very limited in what they can do as well. It's really about funds and economics, but it's about the hustle is really, okay, what can we do with no money? You know, that's basically this. What can we do? How do we strategize? You know, how do we use social media to our advantage? How do we not use social media to our advantage?
Yeah.
You know, who do we need to call? That kind of thing. You know?
Yeah. Any insights you're willing to share on, like, what you can do with little to no money?
Well, I think, you know, I think the thing about, I mean, social media is the greatest gift we have. It's also the greatest, you know,
detriment,
yeah. But in the sense of promoting, you know, like you're promoting yourself and promoting what you do, right? So you have, well, let's say Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, kind of those three, and they fluctuate depending on what genre and what type of market you want. But I think they're all important. What frustrates me when I find artists who aren't, I'm on all three of those things, and I find there's some artists who just only on Instagram, and some are only on Twitter, and some aren't on any, you know. But so there's this, and of course, like no one really, the idea is like, oh, I got to post stuff all the time, blah, blah, blah.
Right.
I mean, that is a huge problem, but you have to figure out your voice. And I feel like every artist, but it needs to figure that out. But you need to use it, because that's where people really, that's where you can get reach people without actually having to pay anything. Now, of course, you can do ads. And
Your time is money.
But you can spend $20 and actually does boost your stuff and get in front of people. That's the idea of like, it's kind of a DIY tool. And you could, you know, share a video, a clip, an audio, all kinds of things. So I think that being on is really important, but I know there's a lot of backlash, like, oh, I don't want to do it, that sucks, that stuff lame. You know, I have artists that have to, you know, work with them. Sometimes I do some of that for them because they don't really want to deal with Facebook, but I was like, cool, I get it, I'll just post that for you. You know, it's not, no problem, but you need to do it. Like, if it doesn't happen, then it doesn't exist, because, like, I know what I'm trying to find out, artists, and, like, I don't see anything. Like, I'm like, I don't, there's this great song, I know nothing about this band because they don't exist anywhere. How do I know where they're playing? How do I know what they're doing? Do they even exist? So I think that's the greatest tool, but it's just figuring out how to make it work for you. I mean, but there's also bad ways of doing it. You know, like, doing it too much and, you know, just hyping your stuff all the time. Or, you know, you're basically supposed to have a communication process with your fans and build a fan base. So, I think that's the greatest tool we have. And then, of course, the idea of, like, you know, you can literally, just distribution is not really a barrier. Anybody can get their music out there and instantly worldwide, right? Just by, you know, kind of signing up for a service or something like that. So, when I was doing college radio, and when starting, it's like you had to get radio play, but you had to then get your records out there. If you didn't have your records, generally people wrote in either mail order, but you didn't have this available to, you know, touch of your phone or button. You had to, like, oh, I'm dying to find your music because I heard it on the radio show. You may not find it for 6 months.
Right.
I remember that process. I mean, it sounds archaic and insane, but the idea of like, oh my God, you finally got it at the record store. Oh, you went to a record store even. You know?
Yeah.
So now anyway, like the point is like, you now have this music you can get out, but if you plan it the right way, like we have a song coming out, an album coming out, we have a decent social media presence, we're building it. You know, that's how you reach people. It's doesn't much cost you anything, right? No. So that's, to me, that's the greatest tool. Now, will you get discovered and make a lot of money? Probably not, but there's all the other things in between that the magic needs to happen.
Yeah. I have to say, there's something about seeing an artist I already love with, and like getting their sponsored ads. I'm like,
oh yeah, no, there's a fine line. It's like, you know, you and it's like, you need to do it, but you need to do it the right time. Like it depends. Yeah. Like you can't do it all the time. Like right. You can't just like be buying ads. And same thing as like buying anything, like, you know, people buying playlisting and that kind of stuff.
You is know. That something you're seeing?
Yeah. And it changes based on the services and, you know, I worked a bit with, when I was working distribution, you know, past few years, I was doing a lot of EDM labels, which is, I found very fascinating, not necessarily my scene, but they were literally just meeting young guys who were, you know, guys or young people that just putting up these tracks, and they were getting like, you know, 5 million streams and, you know, but they were kind of playing the system a little bit. Like there was ways that now all of a sudden they're making money and, you know, but there really was nobody really played live. It was just sort of like this game. So after a while, kind of like, it kind of went away because, you know, Spotify and other services got wise to these games, and it happens, but you should, you know, Spotify will, you can find out, you know, basically the data, you can know when that's us being kind of fake plays, you're yeah. buying plays. There's organic ways of doing it. So it's never really, there is a fine line of sort of like promoting, and there's some tools you can do, but there's a point when like I had a label, I said, hey, you're getting all these plays from Turkey. That's 99% of your plays that aren't coming from anything organic. Don't you find that suspicious? It just kind of shows. And they were like, no, we got the numbers. Like, they didn't care.
Yeah.
But, you know, so there's all these things. There's all these little tricks. There's always an easy, sort of easy way in sometimes, at least seemingly. But it depends.
Is it like buying Twitter followers?
It's sort of, like, yeah. It's like buying followers. Same thing. It's like eventually people know. Like, you know, yeah. They don't have 100,000 followers.
I've never thought about that with streaming.
Yeah, it's the same yeah. game. It's just, you know. But the other thing with streaming is you can make money off it. So,
right.
Because you can get 5 million plays and make money. So that's why Spotify doesn't want you to do that, because they're now paying for something that, you know, basically... No one's listening. But so anyway, there's all these little tricks. I mean, there's, you know, you got to take your risk. And the same thing is like, you know, paying to play a show. It's like the idea of like playing a gig at a venue, or like the whole pay to play, which sometimes still exists. You know,
does
like, I think does somewhere, I'm yeah. sure, right? But, you know, that was a whole thing for a while. But, you know, but basically that exists in some ways, where like buying onto tours, you know, like big tours, you know, that kind of exist. But, you know, you do it because you want to be on the big tour. Right, you're paying, you know, it happens.
I didn't know that was
it happens, you know. I mean, it's like there's all the things you got to do. It's all because, hey, we're, you know, I said we're in the selling dreams business, right?
Right.
Like, everything about the music business is upside down based on everything other parts of business. Like, even when it comes to recording contracts. I remember the first time I had a recording contract thrown at my band, and I showed it to my friend who was a lawyer, who was like a corporate lawyer. And he's like, this makes no sense. Why would you do this deal? It's like, but from our perspective, it was a really good deal because, mm-hmm. you know, they're going to put our record out, you know, even though they owned it forever, the audio and all this stuff, but they were going to, you know, we just wanted to shop, right?
Yeah.
So everything, I always learned from that point, like on, like everything, it's like the deals are just, they can be better, but they're based on being, ripping off the artist. So like the idea of like every so we're always just willing to do stuff. And the same goes into like single licensing, like why do, you know, like, now they're talking about, like, right now the trend is fees are going down because someone's always going to do it for less. Like, someone's going, oh, here's $10,000. Oh, we can get this guy for $5,000 because they really want it. And they'll do it. Or do it for free, you know? Right. So there's battle for the devalue of music because there's always 10 people behind willing to do it for less, right? And this goes to why nobody gets paid at shows and why it's still $10 admission for 4 bands, you know, when beers are $9, which makes no sense to me, you know.
Right.
You know, it's like, because bands will play and do it. They don't care, you know. So there's stuff we got to figure out as a band or a musician or a band or a manager, like, what are you willing to do to get that exposure, right? So it's an age-old story, different technologies, different times, you know. There's always these little things, you know. So, but it's just making a decision. What's the step you need to make to get to the next, you know? Okay, do we have to do that thing we don't want to do to get to the next level?
Right. You know,
play the tour for free because we want to play in front of all these people. You know.
Yeah.
Like it's basically, in the sense, it happens. All, even, you know, most bands who are opening don't get much money at all.
No. Yeah.
Barely even you know, I've had that discussion this week with someone's like, well, I got, we're only getting paid $250, you know, to play like, you know, 600 cap rooms. Mm. That doesn't even cover our cost, but that's just the way the system is, you know, until someone decides not to do that, you know.
Right.
But yeah, there's all these little, you know, you just got to have being awareness. And I think having good news is like, I think artists can find the right team and people to ask whether these are the right moves, and there's never a right answer. I think it depends on the situation, you know.
Yeah.
And but just manage, just trying not to get ripped off, you know. What's, you know, which we're all going to do at one point, just because we got the shot to play the show, or you know, got to play in front of that, you know, favorite band you always wanted to play in, you know.
Right. But I guess there's a couple of ways of asking this, but when you're working with a band, how do you kind of like, what type of questions are you asking? How do you set that path for them? How do you decide?
Yeah, I think it's just generally, you know, and I've had those, some conversations where like, hey, what do you guys want? Oh, we want to get laid and, you know, go get famous, and so that's your goal. Like, that's your goal? Like, and I, you know, they, if they can't really come up with a realistic goal, and I've walked away, like, and you know, some bands have gotten, told me that got really big, and I've walked away from. But I mean, just basically, yeah, just trying to figure out what I need. Like, and I work with some really small bands, and just because I really like the music, and you know, I like the artist development side. But it's just more like, what do you need? Like, what's, you know, sometimes like, ah, you can do that yourself. You don't need me to do that. I'm just going to take a percentage of something that, you know, you probably can do yourself, you know. But I just think it's openness of like what the next steps are. Like, can I help? Do they need my help? You know, what are the tools that we have? It's just, you know, kind of goes different ways. You know, I've had some situations where the band does a lot of stuff themselves and I help them with certain aspects of it, you know. And then there's other times where like I do most of the work, you know, and they don't do any work, you know. So it really depends. But I just like to lay out like, hey, what do you guys do? What are they doing now? Or are they looking to go? What's the next step for them? Mm-hmm. You know, I'm trying to be pretty realistic, both, you know, probably the more negative, like, all right, this is what's going to happen. You're not going to make any money, but this is, you know, just got to see if they're willing to stick it through. And it's hard. I think it's harder and harder these days for bands to be like, or any artist to be. I find there's a fatigue that happens a lot quicker now.
Yeah.
A lot quicker.
Yeah. I feel like everywhere in any industry.
Yeah.
I
think the economics right now are really bad, I think, for touring, for the middle class touring bands. I think it's really tough to get an agent, even draw a label. It's really horrible right now because of consolidation of big agencies, I think. And I'm starting to see a few people break off, start their own thing, but it's like amazing to be like, I had one of my good colleagues said today, looking for an agent. I'm like, you don't have an agent? Like, you thought you played a bunch of shows and yet you're on a big label here. You can't get an agent, you know?
A booking agent.
So, but you know, just cause, you know, again, like there's, big, the touring thing is screwy because, yeah, there's playing Coachella, the big festivals, you can get some good money and stuff like that. If you're hot at the moment, you might be able to make some money, but like the reality is like playing those 200 cap room kind of shows, that sucks because no one, you know, the fees, you know, they said that they're charging like $10, $15 at the door. There's like three or four bands in the bill. You know, the money, there's not a lot of money to go around.
Yeah.
And I just think there's like, and it's been like that forever. I think like that was when I was doing shows in the 90s, it was $10, which is 90s, that's about $18 in money, like in the conversion of the inflation, right?
No.
So like realities were, we were paying more money back then to shows. But I was had a revelation that being a guy drinking beer at shows, like I'm paying $9 for the beer and I'm drinking like four of them probably the night. So I'm spending $50.
Right.
You know, where we're arguing whether we're going to charge $10 or $12 at the door to see three bands. That gets divided between three or four people. Mm-hmm. So anyway, I think it's stuck. So I think that there's a thing that's stuck. And even if you are a band, it's kind of like, you know, you're on a cool indie label, maybe it's $15 a show, but still it's the money just is bad, you know?
Yeah.
Then it jumps to, oh, okay, then it's the $40 ticket, you know, $50 ticket. So there's a huge jump. And I think there's, so that's
35 marks hard for me. I'm like,
yeah. So, you know, I get it. I'm the same too. Like, oh man, you know, but you know, you, the value of what you want to, you know, and I get the point is also like the bands will play for nothing because that's what they want to do. So I think there's even in the booking agent kind of cycle, there's a big gap.
Yeah.
So they're not going to bother with bands who are playing 250 cap rooms, even though they play all the time, because it's like, oh, we just want bands that play at the festivals and get 10 grand and 5 grand, you know. So I don't know. I mean, I don't work as a boogie agent, but I just kind of, that's the impression from the management point of view. But I literally get this asked all the time, but particularly European artists right now, like, oh, who's the booking agent? I'm like, I don't know. Like, they're not reaching out to you. Good luck.
Yeah.
Because it's impossible. You know, I have a couple artists that I finally got some people interested in booking them. But of course, now we're not ready to come over for 2 more years. But, you know, it's like, you know, it's a feast or famine. But, yeah, it's a struggle. I think economics is putting a lot of stress on. Same with labels. Like, why would labels invest in an artist? You have to really have stuff going on before mm-hmm. a label is going to step in and say, I want to sign you and give you some money to record. You have to kind of basically be doing it already.
Yeah.
You know, then at some point, I'm like, well, if I'm already doing it, why do I need you?
That's the
point. So it's just, you know, and I get it, being a guy, you know, so what I do is a label. I became a label because I had artists that were in that situation, got music written, let's just do it ourselves and, you know, come scrape up some cash and do what we need to figure out how to make it work. But I'm finding that there's a lot of those people sitting out there like, oh, I got records and, you know, don't know what to do with. So I'm trying to figure out how to help them out and get that going. Or do I put it out myself? I really don't have the money to put into the project, but that's where we have to figure out how to make it work.
Right. And it's kind of, you're providing experience.
And that's basically, and I'm in no sense a genius on, you know, on that stuff. But at the same time, it's like I work on records, you know, my day jobs over the years, like really big projects. But like, yeah, those big projects have like $150,000 advertising budgets. And of course they're going to be successful because there's like, you know, $300,000 going into it. But when you're like, can we come up with $1,000? What can we do with it?
Yeah.
That's what I do a lot. Like, okay, let's be creative and figure it out. You know, do you hire the public? Do I even hire a publicist is the question I have these days, because publicists aren't cheap.
Yeah.
I think that's a part of the struggle of the economics of like putting together a campaign. Do I hire radio? Which, yeah, you should do radio. But if you're going to take that money, should I put it towards press or radio?
Right.
Or should I put it towards digital advertising on social media? So it's like coming up with like what that fund is and what can we get away with not doing?
Yeah.
You know, so it's, these are the kind of things I try to help out with because I get it. You know, it's like, and I think you can be successful. And I think there are opportunities and you can just click the right way and all of a sudden you can make that money back, you're doing okay, but then you did it without really doing it in a traditional way, which is even more exciting.
Going back to the show thing real quick, I think a part of it is a consumer problem too, because like people bellyache about spending $15 on a 4-band lineup, right? But then they're drinking the beer.
Exactly. No, I said that's when I realized that I caught myself. Like, I went to a show, I think it was a Brooklyn Bowl. What's the gutter beer?
Yeah.
And it was like a $4 show, and there's literally five bands. I'm like, it's $4. It was something like that, $4 or $5. I'm like, that's crazy. I was like, that reminded me of like the old Fugazi joke about the shows being $5 that Todd Barry tell us about Fugazi. Because Fugazi used to always, like, all the shows were $5 for a long time. And then he was like, oh, don't you think, you know, it's like, hey, guys, I'd like to move out of my mom's house. Can we charge $6? You know, kind of joke. But anyway, so I'm sitting there, like, $5 for all these bands. And, you know, it was kind of all new bands. But I was drinking an $8 beer. And I'm like, this is crazy. Like,
I wonder if they're getting a cut of the bars.
I highly doubt it. And if they do, that would be amazing. Sucks. I think that's another problem, because I used to book a club and the bar did give me, like, it was $2 to get in, and, you know, we gave all that money to the band, or maybe, I think, 70 went to the sound guy. It was like a sports bar, and I booked, you know, like, the whole, like, 100 people. The owner gave me 100 or 150, depending on the show. I mean, basically, everybody, all the money kind of went into the show, but, you know, that's pretty rare that happened, and that probably needs to happen. It probably needs to be like, okay, you get 5% at the bar, you know, at $8, $9 beer, it's a lot of money. So anyway, it's just like, and then it's the idea of like you're competing with everything else. I mean, again, being the old guy here, like talking, social media was going to my club. Like that was how you met people. You went out every Sunday. You met people, hung out, because that's where you went to see people. Like,
right.
You know, that was the only thing to do besides maybe watching TV, you know,
or
listening to the radio. But now there's so many other things to compete with. I get it. But we got to figure it out. But it's just the devalue of music in general. I think there is a bit of that. We've kind of like laid this foundation of like music's free on streaming,
right?
You know, you know, this should be really cheap to see shows. And people bitch about it. I know friends who are like musicians and they bitch about it. Like,
yeah.
It's like, you're bitching about getting, especially those people who want to get, my favorite is always like, people want to get in free to show. It's like $5. Oh, can I get in free? Like, why would you come into the bar? You're not going to even, you know, you don't have any money like to come in there. Why would I need your business? You know?
Yeah.
So it's a tough thing. And I've had that conversation with the band. It was like, oh, you know, ticket prices are too high. They're $15. I got some people standing outside the door. They don't have any money. It's like, yeah, but why would they go? I mean, I get it, but like, you don't have any money. It's like, the artist doesn't make any money. They want all the fans to come in. So there's this kind of sweet spot that needs to happen, right?
Yeah.
But I still think it's just basically because people think that everything should be free, you know?
Right.
And then there's that battle that we have to deal with, which is an ongoing issue.
Yeah, totally.
And then it's like, again, like the problem is like there's also stuff that's really expensive. Like the popular stuff is like super expensive. So like people don't have a problem with that.
Right.
You know, spending ridiculous money on hundreds of dollars on tickets for like their popular artists. But it's all the other stuff, the middle stuff. It's like, oh, that's too expensive. It's $50. I'm going to pay that, you know. Or $25. I don't want to pay that, you know.
Yeah. Some friends told me what they paid to see the Stones. I was just like,
yeah, and I get those guys. The Stones, you know, and I just like, I've had those moments like you know, some of the bands always want to see play at a Barclays Center. Like, I can, it's close to my house, be great. But I'm like, I don't want to pay $150 to see Rush or whatever, whoever it was, you know, Neil Young or something. It's like, you know, I'd rather spend to see three $50 shows of something else, you know.
Yeah, it's the only reason why I haven't seen Bob Dylan.
Yeah, I know. So I think we have this economic issue in the sort of artist development world, whether you're manager or label. Like, so even if you are a label putting out, spending traditional money, $10,000 or more on press and radio and a small budget wise, you're not going to see that money back unless you're selling some physical products still.
Right.
The band knows how to do that. That's actually still, realize you can still make money selling, you know, 10 CDs. You can make pretty much good markup there. So 100 CDs, you probably can make, you know, $800 or something like that, you know, if you do it right. And then, you know, the vinyl thing, you know, which is a cost. But, you know, the physical is still a big part of making profit, but you need the money to make those things.
Right.
So the digital stuff is like, people still buy downloads and there's Bandcamp and that kind of stuff. But the reality is most of it's streaming these days. So you have to have a lot of streams to make that money up. So if you look at like, oh, I'm going to spend $10,000 on a campaign, and all of a sudden you're like, we only have 1,000 streams, which is, you know, lucky to get a quarter out of that or something. So like, oh, okay, now what? You know? So it's just this balance of what do we want? What do we want? And because as an artist, you just want to be heard. You know, you really don't. It's an interesting dilemma of you're an artist and a commodity at the same time.
Yeah.
It's even different than if you're like a painter, right? A painter, you're basically painting. Hopefully someone puts you in a gallery. Maybe you sell a painting or two. And you get, you know, but it's not like, but the idea of a musician is daily transactions. Like there's people streaming music all the time. So there's money being generated or in theory. So there's a concern you need to have as a business person. But you're really just an artist, right? So, like, the idea of, like, being, you know, it's like being concerned about your, I mean, some people don't care. I just want to make music, get signed to a label. Like, the old days where you kind of, like, got a lot of money to make music for a while, and you kind of lived off off that touring. And it's hard to define these days. So I think there's this always this, again, everybody wants to have like just do their thing, but then they realize like, well, they say they don't really care about money, but the reality is in the end, it's going to come down to it. Like, okay, the fatigue comes in. You've been doing this for 3-4 years, same way, spending money, but nothing's coming back.
Right.
You hope for stuff like a sync and licensing thing that comes in, which is you got to be part of that game. And just sometimes when you think it's never going to happen, it kind of happens, right? And, you know, it's the kind of classic story. And it doesn't mean it's going to be like, you know, six figures, but it could be like, oh, here's $2,000 for a song on a Netflix series. Like, oh, shit, great. Which is enough for more to
sell the... Yeah.
You know, now I get the new tires for the van or whatever.
Right.
So, so it's just the struggle. But I think, you know, it's less music people. There's always going to be new artists out there doing it, willing to do it. I just like to kind of have that conversation of like, here's how it's going to be. What can we do? What are our resources? How can we get to the next level? Hopefully, you know, I can help, or, you know, we can find people to help bring those things together. But it gets, you know, after a while, you get the fatigue even for myself. It's like, ugh, I've done the rounds of pitching this around. I'm not getting anybody interested, you know. So the idea of like, okay, fuck it, I'm going to do it myself. We'll just do it ourselves. And, you know, that way we can reap the benefits. If you know, there's a lot to be said about that. We can, you do have minor success. You're keeping the money in those things, but you can control it.
Yeah, totally. This is kind of a selfish question. I feel like we've been dancing around it a bit, but what, and it's selfish because I saw a band that I'm like friendly with a few weeks ago, and I asked them when the record was coming out. One of them's like, looked at his calendar, he's like, oh shit, in like 3 days. They would like came here from across the country, and I'm like, oh, did you book any other shows? They're like, oh, we kind of tried, but didn't really work out. I'm like, y'all need a momager.
Mm-hmm. Friendager, momager.
Friendager, yeah. And it just like, I'm like, wait, do I want to try to do that? So
I think absolutely, you know, listen, it's got to be about managing, working with art, whether it's a label or you're a manager or whatever. To me, sometimes they're interchangeable, right? It's like, it's kind of like, to me, it's about the music. You know, like, I dig this. This is, you know, and that's why I still, like, why I still work with artists. And I still, even though I kind of swear off, like, I'm not doing this anymore. Like, then you're like, oh, this stuff's amazing. I really want to figure this out. Who's this person, right? So there's that. It's believing what they're doing. But also just, there is a point of, like, can you work together? Like, right. They have the same vision. And you can try it out. And again, it could be that point where, like, you know, some artists are just deadbeats. They don't really want to do any work. And unfortunately, they're going to have to, you know. And if you can figure out how to make that work for them, like, okay, you can be just the artist and, you know, zone out. I'll take care of everything. That might be the way. It just depends. But I think you have to really just enjoy working together, right? And enjoy, have the same, like, okay, cool, we're going to try this and go with the energy. And even when it's not, even when it's frustrating, I think to me it's always about, like, I believe in the music and I believe someone's going to discover. And I think I've generally been pretty right. Like, people come around like, oh man, I heard that. That's amazing. You know, like, to me, that's enough, right?
Yeah.
The kind of, okay, cool, I was right. Somebody would like this, you know?
Right.
But being successful, it just depends what you, again, like I said, you have to sit down and say like, hey, what can I offer to them? Like,
yeah.
And it's just like, you know, do they need a babysitter manager? Like, right. Someone like, or they just need someone to kind of just give a path, you know? And then it's the idea of like, oh, and I have connections, you know? This is really what they really want, is the connections. But sometimes it's just the path and the vision, you know? It's a coach, right?
Yeah.
There's a lot of that is coaching. And again, it's like coaching the disappointments, you know? I remember I had a conversation with one of my bands a couple of years back. We're streaming, we're still, you know, it's coming around like, we don't want our stuff up on streaming because it isn't paying anyone. I was like, okay, well, look at your last statement from your label, like 50% of the revenue is streaming. It's like, you're not going to make it up somewhere else. Like, if you're willing to give that up, that's fine. But like, and they're like, oh, okay. So I just had to like talk them through the process, you know. And then of course, you know, they got it, they started to become around the streaming, but it's just, you know, that's just part of the understanding. I mean, again, I have a lot more insight because I'm kind of in the thick of the trenches of how this stuff works, you know, from distribution and, you know, but I also book tours myself and stuff like this. So just knowing the reality of it, but also the landscapes is really, I can help explain like, oh, this is how it's going to go. Likely this is what we should do, you know?
Right.
So just there's different ways of doing it. And I think, you know, it's, sometimes it's just fun to work with people that are just you like.
Yeah.
I sort of opened the door a little bit to more projects of like, you know, distributing some releases of friends who have records instead of having them do it themselves. Like, okay, I'll just help you out here and we'll do this and that just because I like the music and I like them. But they were asking me questions anyway. It's like, oh, just buy me a few beers kind of thing, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And I think there's something to be said about being involved with things, because I think what happens is everyone has to do stuff themselves now. So the point is like, yeah, you can get sign up and put your record up on some one of these DIY services, pay $50 and get your album up. A lot of people are doing that, but there's no team. There's like, you're still doing it yourself, right? So like, I think there's a lot of people, and even established artists who kind of feel like, I don't really have the team. I don't make enough money to get a manager. I can't get a label, but I still tour and do my thing and make it work, and I just want to get my music out there. So they're looking for like, okay, how do I do it? What's the strategy? Should I plan the singles, and how do I do this with a higher PR? You know, all the questions we sort of things we talked about. Like, so like, there's a lot of people that just need that help, and I think the problem is everyone's kind of forced into their like little bubbles and are not really part of like the label scene or like a having the support system. And even labels are pretty small, usually one or two people sometimes, small indie labels. And if you're lucky, you get a good staff, you know, a proper label. But yeah, but it's all that stuff. And I've had labels, bands that used to be on labels. Oh, we're starting our own label. Okay, great. And they're like, well, who's going to pay for the vinyl? Like, and you're like, well, you are. Because it's like, oh, okay. I mean, literally, like, those things they don't think about because someone just did it for them.
Right.
Or like, you know, they forget about all the marketing people that they don't really ever dealt with that did all the extra work, and they may have all some of the basics. But then I realize, oh yeah, nothing's happening. Yeah, because you don't have anybody marketing the record, you know, because the label had, you're on a major label before, now you're not, you know. So there's a lot of pressure on the artist to do a lot of stuff, you know. So and they said you have to kind of figure out what they need to do and what they can't do and how to get other people to do it for them.
Yeah.
Or with them, really.
Right. You mentioned that a manager and a label are kind of the same thing in some circumstances today. And I feel like that's what I've heard a lot. It almost feels like a label has replaced like the manager and the PR person. And
yeah, there's a lot of, you know, stories out there, like labels or managed. I think it's like Sargent House is a good example. I think they're a management company too, but like Chelsea Wolfe's records and Sargent House is an example of that. But I think it's, you know, I think bottom line is like, we're all kind of doing the same work, promoting, right? We're promoting, connecting things, labels, managers, publishers. There's a whole team of people trying to promote the artist, but I think they all can cross over, I think, and managers are now starting their labels because of that reason. Because A, they're having trouble finding people to sign them, but also they want to see things happening before. If you can create a demand, and then you have people coming to you for the deals. I think a lot of it started that way. So yeah, and it's just basically the same mindset, just different resources. I mean, I get anybody's a label. You can say, oh, I'm a label, right? Put your record out on, you know, whatever you want to call it, right? It's right. Your label. It doesn't really mean anything. It's just like, it's just that you have to kind of know if you're going to get the things done you need to have done. So I think a lot of record labels do rely on really good managers and there's a good team that works together because they both offer different skill sets. But then again, you're like, I'm surprised where some of the more traditional labels haven't really gotten into the management thing. You know, like, you might as well just do it. You're doing. I worked at labels the past few years as well. Like, wait, why am I doing this? That's not my job. But now it's become the job. You know, it used to be like, well, that's the manager's job. Well, I just did this actually today. I booked a show for some artists I was working with and some label I was working with, a friend of mine, and it was like, no brain. Oh, I'll call up the Steven at piano. Let's get the show. But I was like, that really wasn't my job, but it was like, but I'm sort of helping the guy out. So it's like, fine, you know, it doesn't matter, you know. But it's just like the things you need to do just to kind of get things moving. So I think the lines are blurred. It really depends. But you have to be kind of, the trick is though, like, you don't want to have, like, oh, I'm a label and the manager. You can't, like, take two commissions. That's the only difference, right? You have to figure it out. I have one of the artists I'm working with, or two of the artists I'm working with in Declared Goods. I have a partnership with my buddy Julian Wright, who's a producer in London. He's got a great studio, and he got two projects, the Arthur Brothers and then the Flora Hibbard. Flora's based in London. They're both based in London. And he initially was sort of distributing he found the artist, produced him, and kind of co-wrote a lot of the stuff. And I was like, oh, this is cool, put it out. And then it turned into, like, working together with him. He's kind of like, oh, he's the producer, but he's sort of managing them because he was just doing the work, right? So now we have this kind of joint, like, label management, kind of co-management thing that kind of moved into just because we're just doing all the work. And just it's kind of complicated to figure out how certain things work because he's a producer and gets a cut and all this stuff. But everybody's pretty transparent about it, so it's like, fine, you know. It's just trying to get it lined up. So if it does become successful, there's not any, you know, problems. You know, there's always that. But that's always the advice. Get it lined up early in the relationship so it's not like... And I've done this. I've made mistakes like that before. Like, oh, we'll figure it out later. And then it doesn't work out. Then everybody's kind of pissed at each other because nobody really laid it down. Like, who's going to get what, you know?
Yeah.
That's the hardest part. And that goes with bands, too. Bands that, like, don't realize, like, well, do I have to pay the bass player? You know, do I have to play? You know.
Right.
Does he get a songwriting credit? Well, you got to figure that out, you know. How do you, just different ways to do it, you know?
Yeah.
And it's like, that's where things get messy when you don't get that stuff sorted out. But anyway, I think that it's all blurred. Because, and again, it used to be more separate because there was a lot more money to go around, so people were very separate about it.
Right. Yeah.
So now it's just people doing like, oh, I can do them. You know, it's like the idea of labels becoming publishers. It makes sense when if the situation's right. You know, like I know some labels would like to do that because it's like they don't want to, you know, get messed into those gray areas. You know.
Right. Yeah. It almost seems like there's an opportunity or a world in which a band, from a band's economic standpoint, they're hiring someone to do everything other than getting their stuff pressed, right?
Yeah,
they're
yeah.
doing the booking and the PR and the managing and paying them you know, maybe 15% instead of 10 or whatever.
Yeah, exactly. And I think there's a flexibility, and I'm kind of working that way, like, if all kinds of things come across, and I'm like, oh, let's do this, but let's figure out, let's be fluid on what it could be, whatever this. And sometimes the artist's like, oh, I have money to pay. We can do this, this, and that. Okay, cool. Or it's like, I have no money. You know, you have to work it out, right?
Yeah.
You have to kind of, I have to believe in it. And again, I was talking about the booking agent thing. It's like, yeah, a lot of managers are becoming booking agents, but that's a problem in some issues like in, you know, like in New York and California, I think, particularly like there's legal issues about being agents.
Oh.
And, you know, I mean, if you're small enough, it doesn't matter, but there's a point when like I thought about that, like, because I had two bands in my roster that are basically we're booking ourselves because we can't get agents, and they tour all the time. But what's is easy when you tour all the time, you know where to play, you know, it's kind of easy to figure it out. But it's just the idea of having being tapped into the festivals and the bigger tours and stuff. But anyway, the point is like there is an issue of like, you know, managers really can't be booking agents because there's some technical issues. They have to kind of separate the company. So, but you'll see a lot more of that too. There's like management firms who have that booking division type thing. So I think it's smart. I think it's becoming more like you're becoming a full service and good, you know, like it's like your management, label, booking agent, we just do stuff that needs to get done, you know.
Yeah.
There's a big advantage there. And I think in some ways the management, that is probably the more power. I think labels generally just like to stay away from all that stuff. They don't want to be labels, so they just kind of do the marketing and that type of thing. But and they may dabble in publishing, but rarely will they book a show for the bands. But you know, it does happen once in a while.
Yeah. Do you want some more water?
I'm good, thank you.
Switching gears, do you want to talk about any of your artists that you have stuff coming out, or you're particularly excited? I'm sure you're excited about all of them.
Yeah.
But
oh, they're always good. They're all my favorites.
Yeah.
I'll talk about the Flora Hibbard. We've got an EP coming out on November 1st. And we've been going through, and she's based in Paris, but she is from London. Very dark folk stuff. What's pretty excited about, because the production is pretty amazing. So, but that's been kind of a slow process. We put a couple singles out, got some good press. We're just finishing up a video that was filmed in London. Trying to decide, you know, what the artist is happy with versus what the director is happy with. But we've got some good tools, and just, you know, we have a, I'm excited about that coming out. And there's been a little bit of, now I can kind of like, that EP's coming out, we have a show in London that we can kind of invite people to come see her. We're kind of like developing her. There's been interest in publishers and some labels too. But just trying to get her on the radar, you know. So my partner Julian, Clear Light Records, it's his project. I'm not going over to London to the show, but he's handling it. Excited about that. Got this Brooklyn band Tough Sunshine. John Laterra has been around for a while, so I'm working on his record. That's kind of a loose arrangement, sort of like me distributing and marketing his record, which was really great. You know, I heard it. He's like, you know, it's one of those things like, hey, I'll help you. I got no money, but we'll figure this out. Yeah, let's do it.
Yeah.
Because I can, you know. So, and to me, it's just kind of fun to be able to be part of these kind of just good projects. I think what I got, and then this Arthur Brothers, another pretty intense UK band, but hard to explain. Two brothers, Arthur Brothers, obviously, that Julian also produced, and it's a pretty bombastic project. It's like somewhere between like a old Cold War Kids and like Tears for Fears. That's just like a big, big sounding record. It's been kind of slow process of building them up in Europe particularly. I think we'll have an album out next year. But it's just, again, like just trying to get people to be interested. It doesn't sit anywhere. It doesn't sound like anything else. So it's kind of harder to be like, but when people do hear this, like, what the fuck is this? This is amazing. But it doesn't sound like a scene or anything. So that's, which I guess that's kind of why I like it, but it doesn't make it really easy to get the things you need, like, you know, get it on a playlist, that kind of stuff, right? Or even radio play.
Which is funny because I feel like the company I work for, we talk about being like genre agnostic and like,
there's a difference being genre agnostic, which I think now means make it sound like the playlist stuff.
Oh,
that's a difference. I think I have a bit of a problem with that, because I think there's a point to it. And I kind of like the idea of, like, in theory, like, who cares about whether it's punk or it's pop or whatever, right? In theory, but I look at it as like, I kind of liked it when there was a divide of like, you know, that's underground, that's pop. I mean, there's something about to be said. Like, I think everyone's kind of going for this big push. And it goes, I think it even goes to some artists that are like, they may have been kind of more edgy underground artists. All of a sudden they switched, like, wait, that just sounds like Lorde all of a sudden. Why did that happen? Like, everything sounds like Lorde. And there was a point where, like, everything sounded like Lorde, right? You know, or whatever the hot, you know, there's always like that, oh, this is the sound right now.
Right.
And I feel like there's a bit of a problem because there is a globalness, because everything is globally distributed, so people can hear these global playlists and it sounds like the playlist.
Yeah.
So I consider it the playlist genre. Mm-hmm. It's like there's a I think there's a problem with that. And then there's like the, and even like kind of more R&B hip hop mix of indie stuff. Like, there's that. And to me, that has become such a like, oh, that's just everybody trying to mix hip hop and indie together. You know, it's like, so anyway, I think it just goes by what people listen on playlists, which is what, again, with Spotify and, you know, Apple kind of do. And like, so like, I think they're just, because it's a mixed bag of stuff, right? So it's like all these artists are kind of put together, but you're not really going to hear like a metal track put in there, right? So like, the reality is like, there's still like divides. I think you do need to be unique, but I think there's some reason I'm just sense that I feel like, yeah, people are trying to be unique but also being very palatable for a playlist, which is not, shouldn't be the goal. I'd rather be like, let's make it unpalatable with the playlist. That's when I get interested, right? Like, I want to, it's like, what the hell is that sound? That is crazy. You know, to me, that's more interesting. And I think, honestly, like, depends what you want to go for. Like, I come from the kind of, like, you know, the world of, like, underground music from even to the 80s and the 90s, like, you know, Bottle Surfers and, like, you know, Dinosaur Jr., when no one was seeing Dinosaur Jr. You know, these are bands that started things. Like, they were different sounding bands, you know. I come from that world, and I've kind of, like, always have a leaning towards, like, more edgy underground things. I think there's those bands out there, but there's definitely a movement right now to be very mainstream, right? And I think it goes to the genre thing. So that's my opinion anyway. So, I've worked this, you know, there's an artist named Tula out of Sweden who lives in Germany now, but I've been managing her for a year, and she's, you know, she had an EP out. She's kind of a talented pop singer, you know, but she's also like a singer songwriter, and I can identify her. She can play guitar, and so it was really not different except for like, trying to make things happen in that pop world is a totally different element than like, get in the van and play a show, which is in most cases is the best way. I think playing shows is still one of the best ways to promote your music. Not necessarily by, it's not only about people coming to the show, it's about being listed somewhere.
Oh.
So the idea of like playing a gig and people see a name on a flyer or show, or like even posting a bunch of dates on that shows up on, you know, social media or Spotify, like, oh, they're playing shows. To me, that is part of the game. If you're not, like, the idea of not doing anything is like, people see that, like, oh, what's the band up to? I like them. Oh, nothing's going on. I lost interest, right? So, anyway, it's the idea of like, I think touring is just basically getting, or even not touring, but just getting out there playing. Could be like touring Brooklyn, I don't know, but whatever. It's playing shows.
Yeah.
Shows you're doing stuff. I think it's frustrating, back to what we were saying about making money. Frustrating for artists because like, it's a drag playing the same thing, and you know, no one comes out or don't get paid, whatever. But you got to do it. You're a musician, right?
Right.
Shouldn't you want to do it? They figure it out. You got to just keep moving forward, and you got to either do it, and like, you just never know. But I think that's where like, it's still an important part. And I've actually had a conversation with one artist who's like, well, I don't want to play the small venues. I want to play the big venues. Like, well, how do you think you're going to get to the big venues?
Right.
If you don't. But there's like, there's that mentality sometimes, like, well, I can skip all that because my friends' bands are doing that stuff. Because that's what they see. They don't see the fact that they're actually, you know, doing all the tiny shit that's kind of sucks sometimes. But the idea of doing shitty gigs is how you get really good.
Right.
Playing the venues that don't have working PAs and,
right.
you know, everything goes wrong. That's how you become good. Those are the best shows, I think, that every artist needs to play. But also, like, it promotes you, too, because you're, like, you know, you're listed somewhere, right?
Yeah.
You just can't be sucky all the time. You got to be eventually good because people won't see you anymore. But
yeah. Saw a band recently. It was my first time seeing them, and they put on a great show. And I was with some friends who had seen them, like, a year or two before. And they're like... Last time I saw them, like, they were good, like, yeah. you know, and I, but this time they've, like, really tightened up. Yeah, you know,
I mean, it's like, yeah, and you can do that. You can do that in this, you know, rehearsal studio. You know, I mean, I remember when I played, we rehearsed all the time.
Yeah.
I remember even some of our friends, like, you guys practice too much. They're like, you know, we just play the same song 10 times until we got it right. But I still don't think we were that great live. But anyway, yeah, it's something to be said about the
live. You also learn about the energy.
Yeah, and the live thing is different because, like, it's about putting you in a situation because you can be, I think, and I work a lot of Swedish artists, and there's a tendency over the years because touring wasn't really much their what they did, but they basically were all studio bands, and they're really good bands, right? Good, but, like getting them on the road and, like, becoming good live bands is a different story, you know? Yeah. And I think it's part of having, like, again, like, playing the shitty back room that stuff's not going right. It's edgy because you're, like, you know, whatever. The environment is, like, unsure. There's something to be said about learning how to do that. No matter what kind of music you're playing, it could be, like, guitar, it could be, like, you know, laptop pop. It doesn't matter. But just understanding that stuff. Because, right. like, if something goes wrong... You know, the hard drive's not working or something. Like, you got to figure out how to do it. You're still there. Like, that's the worst thing. It's like, oh shit, the computer shit the bed. You know, what are we going to do? Well, you got to figure it out. If either you're going to continue to show or not. But that's where you learn the ropes. You know, it's like, you got to have a plan for that. This next time you know how to make it happen, right?
Right. Side note, before I ask you the next question, have you ever heard of the band Slow Mass?
That sounds familiar.
Okay. I just learned about them, and I was listening to one of their albums, like, walking from, like, Flatiron to Soho or something, and every song is different.
Interesting. Like a different could style. Be in a
I was like, this is what music should be.
That's interesting, yeah, and I think there's something said about that. I do like artists who do very different things, but then there's that problem of, like, getting identified, you know, like it's like a brand, you know, people want
to still be their post rock band,
but yeah, I mean, it can't be too, you know, it's like they have to be going too far on the edge, but like, you know, be like, oh, is that Slow Mass? I'm not sure, like, that's I want to be able to do that,
yeah,
right? And it's like, oh, it's like, I mean, like, to me, I never liked the Strokes, like, they sound the same all the time, like, there's like kind of like, oh, I know what the Strokes are going to sound like, I know the next record's going to sound like, mm-hmm. that would, you know, to me, you know, there's certain bands like, but people would like that. Like, for, you know, I also like The Cure, and they pretty much have a sound, you know, but they although they had a period where they were very, like, you know, and they're kind of like before they got pretty big, like, they were doing very different stuff, like, all of a sudden, like, they mm-hmm. were kind of experimenting, but it kind of shows their growth. But anyway, I find that very interesting. It's like, you know, there is a fine line where you can be like, you have to kind of find your thing, otherwise people aren't gonna identify with it.
Right.
So it's like being even a painter, that, like, you can paint, that you gotta be consistent in what you're doing.
Yeah.
Because otherwise people don't know what you're about, you know.
Yeah.
But I think that is the challenge, because we do listen to so many different types of music, right? Because we have access to, you know, you listen to hip hop, you can listen to, you know, shoegaze, whatever. And you try to, so you're probably everybody's influenced by that stuff. But I have that problem. I don't really play much anymore music, but I think about now, like, what would I do if I was in a band? Like, I couldn't, because I had just so many things I like. Mm. I'd have to figure out what that would be. You know, what do I want? In fact, when I was playing music, it was like, oh, shoegaze and grunge was not we didn't really exist then. That was, you know, was sort of what you were doing, you know. But it would just end up being the moment. But but it was like kind of, that's what was played on the radio, and that's all I had access to, you know.
Right.
Yeah.
How did you break into the Europe thing? How do you end up with all these European artists?
Yeah, it's kind of interesting. I really fell into the Swedish scene. I mean, I had connections with people in Europe over the years, from touring over there and playing and meeting people. But the Swedish thing kind of came up because I was really loved this record by this band called the Caesars. And in 1998, they had their first record. And so I'm into Fresh, and that was awesome. It was garage rock. It was kind of like the period when the Hives were kind of coming through and all that stuff. And I found out they had another record, but the label wasn't going to put out the next record coming. So I got in touch with them through their Swedish label and the artist, and we just sort of like, oh yeah, I want to shop this around kind of thing. So got some interest in Sub Pop was interested in some, you know, there's some labels. So long story short, like, so then, you know, I got involved that way just because I really loved this record and I wanted to help them. And then I got invited to go up there and then, you know, kind of met, and I kind of went in the right, it wasn't for a little while later, but I finally went up there. And, but I was kind of in there at the right moment where I basically got friendly with all these people, and the business was not a, you know, not a really big business in Sweden in some sense, where there's like, you meet like 10 people, you know, everybody runs everything. But I, you know, they happened to know the right bands who were connected to other bands, and next thing you knew, it was like friends of friends of friends, and you know, Then I had like, you know, worked with the Caesars, Peter Buren John, Loney Deer, you know, the Radio Department, all these bands kind of just kind of came out of this meeting a few people. And it happened, you know, it just happened to be like super immensely talented people.
Yeah.
Like they were like Jukka Allen from Caesars, Late Big Bird, who I work with now, and Teddy Bears. Like, he's got a hip-hop band, he's got a krautrock band, he's got a garage rock band, you know, and he writes, produces records and stuff. Bjorn Yttling, Peter Bjorn John, also was a keyboard player in the Caesars, but then had his own band and produces big records. So these were all like friends that I like, met just by liking a record and reaching out to them.
Yeah.
So, and that's why I said, like, to me, it's always been the driving, the music fanboy me is kind of drives stuff.
Yeah.
I think that's the best way to do it. Cause I feel like, well, if anything, like, liked hanging, like great, made great music and like hanging out with them, whatever, you know, right. It's like, but then the reality is like trying to help them out what they need, you know? So I became kind of the go-to for a while and worked with the Radio Department. I had a partner, Pear. We worked on a bunch of the bands together. But, like, you know, their Radio Department came over to New York to play, and they're, like, playing a show. And I was like, why are you playing? It was, like, kind of an oddball place, just playing one show. I'm like, why aren't you guys touring? They're like, oh, we don't know. We're just here. We got invited. You know, they didn't have a manager and stuff. So, the, you know, the idea, like, hey, I'll help you. Like, oh, yeah, you need some gear. I got a bass, and I got a guitar, and I got drums, you know. Sort of offering help. So just sort of like, I just look at it as like, I wanted to help people to do the right things and not do the wrong things and make sure they're the right, I'll make sure you play that venue next time, or, you know, that kind of thing. Or you should, you know, play a show here too. You know, so that kind of just started by just sort of offering my services to people. And at that point, it was like early 2000s, was like a lot of the Swede stuff was happening. There was a lot of bands, Licky Lee was coming around and all that stuff.
Yeah. Know.
So yeah, just by liking some music, you know. And then reaching out, which is generally how most of the stuff comes.
Yeah, totally. Before I ask you the last few questions, ask everyone, you mentioned a music video. Do you feel like they still have their place?
Absolutely. I think, here's the thing. So music videos are absolutely immensely important. Just don't spend any money on them. Make video, be creative, because that's how you use them in Instagram. I mean, even if it's like a 30-second, that's how you engage people. Yeah. I mean, honestly, so the problem I have with this one video I'm working with is, like, you know, my partner paid, you know, somebody a decent amount of money, you know, not no huge budgets, but like, to me, like $500 is a lot of money for video, right? So it was more than that. And the problem is, you can spend $50,000. Doesn't mean the video is going to be any good. It just means like you paid $50,000 and probably looks like it was shot professionally. But does anybody really going to care whether it's a $50 video or a free video or a $50,000? I don't think anybody is going to care on blogs, or it's just a video, right? So, and so I've had the challenge of a couple of my artists, like I work at Gringo Star. I manage them. Gringo Star's from Atlanta, and they've been around for a while. So they've had these, luckily for over years, they had like some brothers out of Dallas, I believe they were, who were filmmakers, and they were kind of experiment by doing videos for the band. They loved the band. So they had, like, when I first started working, they had like literally these amazing, like, shot on film kind of videos, like shot on film videos, not like digital videos. Cool stuff, you know, nothing high concept, but great looking stuff, you know. And then all of a sudden they weren't available for the next record, and I was like, we need video. And I was like, all right, use your phone, go make it. And then one of the brothers in the band just made this great video, like just shot it. And we started kind of doing that. And, you know, I've done that too. I do a lot of videos as well. And just using an iMovie and stuff. So I'm always like, you need videos, you need content. So, but I think it's not like the MTV days where like a video gets played and everybody's like, oh, wow, there's a video I see everywhere. It just doesn't work that way anymore.
Yeah.
Now, occasionally there's some cool videos people share virally, but I just think it's just content that's needed, absolutely needed. But you need to, I think you should spend zero on it and have your friend or do yourself, just who knows how to use iMovie and just have fun with it.
Yeah.
Those are the cool videos. Those are the coolest videos, and it could be something totally just dumb, you know. Mm-hmm. I think that's the way to go. It's always nice when you can have a high concept video and stuff, but it's not worth
it. Or if you have the money to pay someone who's like talented to.
Yeah, but I said even so, like again, there's problems sometimes. Like sometimes it just doesn't come out the way you want, right? And that's it's kind of the problem having a certain, you know, the artist wasn't happy with the final thing, and I have to either was like not gonna come out because I like it, but like even though I thought it was great, you know, but like, you know, you have to be respectful of that stuff. But at the same time, the director was like, don't fuck with my vision, you know, kind of thing. Yeah. So anyway, it's complicated, but I think they're absolutely important because marketing yourself and marketing your product, that's really what everybody needs. I mean, it's the video premiere on the, you know, the
stereo film.
It doesn't really mean anything. You're going to get 300 views and it doesn't matter.
You're going to get more clicks for that publication than you are.
Yeah, it doesn't, but it's like, you know, there's a time like, hey, there's an engaging video, like those do work and it does help and it does, people will share it, and it's like you need that, so you just got to figure out what to do. I think that they're really an important thing. We just got to figure out how to make them from nothing, you know. Totally. But I think we were talking about the phone earlier, like just you make it, you can do this stuff on your phone, just learn, get iMovie, it's easy to go.
Yeah
totally.
Cool, last few questions.
Sure.
Well, I feel like you've already given a lot of advice to artists. Any advice or lessons, tidbits for people interested in getting into music business?
Don't do it.
Yeah.
You know, I think it's just, and I think I always think of a joke as a music hobby, not music business. Mm-hmm. I think if you approach it that way, it's like, and again, it's an art. I went into myself as an artist, but I always was interested in being part of the music, you know, business sphere, whatever that was. When it was college radio, I moved to labels and stuff. I interned at labels, you know, interested me, like managing bands. And there's so many different aspects of it. So I think you can go to school, NYU, and learn stuff. I do some guest, you know, speaking at my friend's classes at NYU about how to do, set up digital releases and stuff like that. And we kind of talk about stuff. So I think there's, can do that. I don't know if it's worth paying money to go to NYU for to learn that stuff. I mean, I think you can probably sit down with me for a week and like we can drink beers and figure it out. You know,
right.
I mean, I don't have the answers to everything, but it's just basically figuring out how to make it do it. I think it's an entrepreneurial business, really.
Mm.
So it's like, to me, like when working with some of those EDM labels, it's like these guys literally didn't know how anything was done except for they're really good at producing tracks, knowing how to hustle them on SoundCloud and YouTube. But when it came down, they made money. They didn't know how to do royalties. They didn't know anything, right? So they're like, oh, what is this? How does this statement work? And I was like, well, you're kidding me. You don't have deals with your artist? You know, but he was already like, these guys are businesses, right?
Mm.
So they were just kind of rolling with it. But that's the great thing about music business. You can do that. I mean, you can be kind of set up on the label, find a couple of bands, you're putting them up. Fake it until you make it, right?
Right.
So, it has to be about the passion. But I think if it's really about, I think it can be like, yeah, I know I can make money on this because I have an angle, which is really like any business, like figuring out how to make the next step work. But it really should be about like how to figure out how to like work with a type of music or a scene or something, right? That's really where the energy is going to come from. It ain't going to be from waiting for your royalty statement to come in.
Yeah.
Because you're going to start. I actually was working with a pretty established like studio label guys, and they've been in business forever, started a label, and they were like immediately frustrated, and they're like, I was meeting with them, they're like, wow, this didn't quite go as well. They thought they were just going to release stuff and things were going to happen. And how much work it was, right, to kind of get people to react. So they finally got it figured out. But it's, you know, I've seen that, like, you know, people have been in the business a long time and trying to make it work now, it's different. So I think you just got to do it for the passion of the music, and particularly if you have a scene of people, musicians or friends you're a part of, and you can, don't have to be in New York, you don't have to be in LA, you can be anywhere, right? Just that's where the business starts. It doesn't have to be technically like you that have a degree or you just got, you know, go online and learn it, read some books. It's pretty easy. I mean, I kind of figure that's the way I've done it. Like, it's kind of fake it till you make it, you know?
Yeah, totally.
Just kind of like, you're like, oh shit, that's how that works. I didn't realize that, you know?
Yeah. Any recommended books you
can
think of?
There's a couple of those. I forget the name. There's a couple of those classic like music business. I totally forget. It's been so long. But there's a couple of those classic books. At least teaches you like the law stuff. Like, you know. And contracts are key. I think you need to have I mean, you basically can ask someone to like use, hey, I need a can you give me a basic contract template for management or label thing? You know, the problem is like hiring a lawyer and stuff like that also come to cost money, and so you have to be able to, it's always advisable to do that, but I think there's a lot of stuff out there, and I've done those myself. Like, oh, here's something I pulled offline, this art, you know, like artist contract. It's a start anyway, but it's like you have to understand certain things. Like, it's learning stuff like what's the difference in publishing, what's the difference between master rights.
Yeah.
Those type of things are really key, because that's for, I mean, it's confusing for me still,
so
but
confusing.
That is a key thing, understanding those things, because. And understanding where the revenues come from, you know, as like we had talked before about this, but the understanding, like, there's publishing money that comes from every single stream that you do. Now, how to get that publishing money is a trick. You have to figure that out, you know. So this stuff like that, you just need to kind of ask around. The good news is you can Google it and probably find out.
Yeah, totally. What does success mean to you?
That's a good question. I mean, success in the sense of working in my career is like, again, the fact that I'm still able to do it and not have to have a construction job or something, which actually may be kind of interesting.
And maybe more lucrative in New York.
You know, I say I was envious. The rock stars in my neighborhood are the guys who work in the sanitation trucks. Those guys all own houses. They're all in my neighborhood. They're like guys. Yeah. Who do, like, those guys, to me, like, that's a rock star job, because you don't have to, they work hard, don't get me wrong, but they have limited hours or in union, blah, blah, blah. But anyway, so like the success to me is like, to me it's like having, again, I'm able to still do this. I'm still employable. People still come to me with projects. As I get older, and since I've been doing this for a long time, since the 80s, I realize, am I the old guy, just out of touch? But, you know, I think I still have something to add to people. But it's really not about the money, although it should be about the money. I think there's new economic things I'm trying to figure out. Like, you can make it work this way. You don't have to really worry. Again, I'd realize I could become a label, which I want to do more without really having any money.
Yeah.
And it's basically about the hustle more than it is about spending to get stuff back.
Like focusing more on digital?
Well, yeah, it's mostly digital. Stuff. Yeah, but it's like figuring out the small steps. And I think, I remember talking to one of my labels I was working with years ago, and they're like, and they kind of like, they've had a really good run, like 10 years or so, and they were struggling kind of growing to the next level. They had big success, but then they were like, we couldn't figure out the new digital sphere. And I was like, well, what was your first record you put out? Like, we put some 7 inches out. I was like, well, how many did you press? Oh, like 300 or something. I was like, well, what happened when you sold out those first 300? Like, we were so psyched. And then we just repressed more. I was like, well, start thinking like that again. Like,
right.
You have to kind of take a step back and think, like, you know, sometimes growth can be, too much success can be a problem, because you know, there's only so much you can do, I guess. But you have to kind of always revisit what you need to do. And I had more success years ago working with artists that managed, or like Peter Buhner and John were successful, and I was working with, you know, making good money in that. I don't really have that wheelhouse of management right now, and it's fine. I have projects I'm working on, I'm excited about. They're not making a ton of money, but we're going to any minute though. But but that's where, like, to me, like, but it's putting out music that and declared goods, that's like, oh, cool. Somebody liked this. Someone posted about that today. That's cool. You know? So, I mean, that's sort of like the, I guess, the utopian version of success, I guess. But the idea of like, yeah, I'm still able to just work in the music industry.
Yeah.
Is like successful enough. And I pretty much all I've done. So, which is, pretty interesting.
Yeah, totally.
I mean, you got to hustle some other things once in a while, but, you know.
Yeah.
Play the lottery.
Yeah. Work in tech.
I remember learning. I worked at doing marketing for a company, it was distribution, but I was building databases, you know, Access, back then it was Access database, because like I needed a database for all these record stores. And all of a sudden I kind of got into the programming world a little bit, and then went, got another job, and they had a tech team, they're like, they're gonna build this new, you know, portal for doing that database. And I was like, you should do this and this. And they're like, how do you know this stuff? I was like, because I just did it, because I had to do it, you know.
Yeah.
So I kind of all of a sudden I always like to have my foot a little bit in that side, because, but then you realize how much money those people make, on the basic level.
Yeah.
Like, wait a second here.
Right.
And that's the problem with the music industry now is that the what is tech world? Spotify, Apple.
Yeah.
They're tech businesses. You know, everything about music business is tech right now. Apps.
Yeah.
So this is really just, you know, big difference between the business. Like, we're like, you know, I have people that pitch me like, oh, I got this new app that you can use for this and royalties and stuff. It's only $50 a month that you use for the band. I'm like, do you know how many streams my band has to have to pay $50 a month just to have some, you know, specific insight? And I was like, I like this, but I just, you know, in the budgets of all the things I need to spend on, I'm not going to spend it.
Right.
And I've had those conversations with a lot of people, like, that's my first, and I always try these things out because I think there's great tools, and sometimes they, you know, get merged into things like, what's like Pandora and Amped, where these great tools. But anyway, I have to remind people, like, there's no money for, what you think you're going to get from music business, like, forget it. Like, unless you're talking to the big guys, the big majors, like, no artist has got money for this stuff, you know, or they're going to spend it on fixing the flat tire versus the, so anyway, yeah, it's just, it's a really tough, it's tough when you're, the music industry is the tech world right now.
Yeah, it's true.
And but it's also great opportunities. So that's the thing. It's like there's a lot of data and stuff we didn't have, and you can distribute stuff, and you can. So that's you have to kind of balance out those things.
Yeah, just know that they're looking at their bottom line. A lot of them are.
Yeah.
First, obviously. Cool. Last question. What's something you're excited about today?
Excited about. Well, I would say like. I can't even tell you, say I'm excited about, I couldn't, like what kind of music, whatever, but.
It can be literally anything.
Yeah, I'm trying to think about what I'm excited about. It's tough to get excited about things that are, especially with the news going on today.
Yeah. Potential impeachment?
That's a tough one. It's hard to even like conceive of like being excited about things. But, you know, I think it is, like, I am excited about the music and stuff at work, but that keeps me going. Honestly, but Peaky Blinders starts this week, season 3, whatever it is, 4, whatever the new one. So that, I'm excited about that, just because that's the escape thing, you know.
Yeah, I hear that.
There you go. That's stupid, but I'm excited. Those were small things. Those binge watching shows that we do that get escape, you know.
Ed Tyler and Deer on here. One time, and he said the same thing. He was like excited about some terrible show on Netflix.
Yeah, I think that's what it is. I think that's just stuff because we're kind of learned, oh, that's coming out, or like the new Breaking Bad movie or whatever, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm excited to go see Stereolab on Saturday. I haven't seen them in a long time, but like there's all small things, but yeah, I think that's the stuff that's, that you look forward to. Like, oh, cool. It starts on Sunday.
Sure. Actually, I won't even be at 10. Where are they playing Stereolab?
They're playing at Brooklyn Steel, both Friday and Saturday.
Super sold out.
Yeah, but I'm sure also those tickets were sold 8 months ago, and there's probably people who aren't even in town.
That's true.
That's the thing about these shows, and they're so far out that I forget about them sometimes. Like, oh shit, I have tickets for this show. And like,
yeah.
But also people are like, no, I'm not in town anymore. I can't. You know, I bought them. I got rid of them. So I think they always come up.
Yeah.
But that's gonna be exciting. I know it's been a while since I've seen them.
Totally. Cool. Well, thanks for doing this.
Well, thank you. Thanks for listening.